Here, you note that I have a quorum. The first bill this afternoon I'm going to take up is Senate Bill 732. It's sponsored by Senate Resource Committee. It's related to the mining claims and leases on state lands, including tide and submerged state lands. The House Resource Committee adopted a CS which provided the rental fees for tide and submerged lands shall be $3 per acre for each year, payable at the end of each year. The Senate version provided that the fee shall be $3 per year for the first 2 years period of the permit, payable at each of the periods, and $1 per acre for each year thereafter. The Senate Resource Committee also adopted a letter of intent which is included in your bill file. A fiscal note from the Department of Natural Resources indicates that $47,900 will be needed to fund a land management officer to handle the administration loan required under the legislation. This afternoon we have Senator Fernkamp to testify on this bill and answer any questions. Amy, would you take care of Representative Bettis Worthy?
I've got it anyway.
Nobody has. Doesn't he have the bill packet?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betty Farringham, Chairman of Senate Resources. You've explained this bill very well, Mr. Chairman. I probably should just answer questions. The main thing is that it's a necessity for those people who are mining throughout the state that are in the production phase right now. Due to the 6I section of the Statehood Act, and I think most of you have heard of it over the past 2 or 3 years, and this is an agreement worked out between DNR, the mining community, others involved, as to how we can handle the 6I to protect the miner who is producing on state lands. We have people from DNR, the Mining Association, and preferred questions.
Representative Cotton and Representative Makers.
What did we do last year?
Last year we passed a resolution to get them through till this year to leave them.
What did that resolution do last year? The situation is that I can't remember what exactly the 6I problem is when it comes to
it's in the statutes in your deal. It's says that all grants or mining would be under a lease program in state. And we've been under a file claims, et cetera. So this lease and this bill is as close to the present claim system as we can get.
So this isn't a temporary solution. Last year there was a temporary solution. This is what the department and the Plaster Miners Association agreed to this compromise.
Yes, it is. It's the state itself has no interest in it. In that, their only interest is to try to get those who deal with the legal cases.
Representative Meekins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Administration had a position paper on this? I can't see it in there. I can't see this one, though, whether they're for it or against it.
The administration is for it, testified for it in committee, both committees. They're here now.
And this did have a hearing in the Resources Committee?
Yes, it did. It's had a hearing in Resources and in Finance, and in House Resources
and
Finance.
Okay, thank you.
Is there any further questions, Representative Hodges?
Mr. Chairman, I move and ask unanimous consent to Senate Bill 732, Finance Mineral Extractions from State Land, pass out of committee.
And also included in your motion is the intent language
and
the fiscal note.
And the fiscal note.
Is there any objection? If not, Senate Bill 732 is moved out of House Finance.
Thank you.
Senator, did you have any other bills on the calendar today? I don't think so.
No.
Okay. The next bill we'll take up is Senate Bill 146. Senate Bill 146 is sponsored by Senator Bradley, provides for the payment of a burial allowance on the death of an eligible veteran. The Senate bill provides for a $500 payment, while the House State Affairs Committee substitute increased the amount to $750. This version also changes the definition of veteran to provide that the person who it was or is in the armed forces must have been a state resident for 1 year before his induction and who returned to the state within 1 year after discharge. If the veteran was not a resident at the time of induction, he must have been a resident for at least 1 year at the time of his death and have previously lived in the state of Alaska for 5 years. The veteran must be buried in Alaska. The Division of Loans and Veteran Affairs estimate that 284 claims will be filed in FY83 at the cost of $213,000. In addition, $3,100 in personal costs would be expected, bringing the total bill to $216,100. Is anybody here to testify on Senate Bill 146?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Meekins.
Just a technical question. I believe you were quoting the fiscal note of 210.81, and we have a new one of 129.82. And does that supersede your number, and would it then be 157.5 in the new number?
No, the new number would be reading off of a fiscal note dated 210.81.
Sir.
Okay.
Okay. That's the accurate one.
That's the accurate one, yes. What's the pleasure of the body?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Montgomery.
I move the report Senate Bill number 146 and the fiscal note out.
Is there any objection? Senate Bill 146 is moved out of committee. The next one we'll take up is Senate Bill 545. Senate Bill 545, originally sponsored by Senator Bennett. It makes changes relating to release on bail after conviction of an offense. Current law does not allow a person to be released on bail either before sentences or pending appeal if the offense the person had been convicted of a murder in the first degree, robbery in the first degree, kidnapping, or sexual assault in the first degree. The House Judiciary Committee adopted a committee substitute which also provides a person may not be released on bail for the following additional offenses: manslaughter, criminally negligent homicide, assault in the first, second, or third degree, sexual assault in the second degree, robbery in the second degree, burglary in the first degree, arson in the first degree, escape in the first degree, and riot. The Divisions of Corrections indicate that five additional beds would be necessary. The cost of these beds would be $345,000, and the division assumes that they would be incorporated into another capital project. It is also assumed that any personnel that would be required would be built into the budget of the institution. As a result, the division's fiscal note does not need to be adopted. In addition, the Department of Law and the Department of Public Safety indicates no fiscal impact. Is there anybody here to testify on Senate Bill 545? Mr. Cook.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bill Cook, counsel for the House Judiciary Committee. If it's your desire, I'll make a brief explanation of the differences between the Senate bill and the Judiciary Committee.
Please.
Thank you. The present law, as you correctly stated, Mr. Chairman, is that only first-degree murder, not second, and first-degree robbery, and one type of first-degree sexual assault, that is actual penetration, and kidnapping, are covered under the present law, denying bail before sentencing and during appeal. However, that law has been thrown out by the Alaska Court of Appeals. It's been ruled unconstitutional in Griffith versus Alaska.
Mr. Chairman.
Bill. Yes.
Excuse me, Mr. Cook, I have a question, though, just to get on track. Is this bill, this House Judiciary Committee substitute for 545, the same as a bill by Anderson that has previously passed the State House? Is it identical exactly?
It's the same as five, that's correct. The
And I'm wondering, did that bill...
The Violent Crimes Task Force, Bill 578.
And did that bill go to the Finance Committee also? I'm just wondering if we've already passed the exact identical bill out, then I'm not sure.
I believe that's correct, but the Senate bill came over before the House bill. I don't think this has ever been voted on the floor of the House, but you're right. The exact 18 same crimes are listed in House Bill 578 as in this bill.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
My own thinking was I think that the leadership has to get an agreement on which vehicle they're going to use if they're identical, but perhaps we should move this on to rules. But since we've already done it before, maybe we could just make the motion is what I was getting at.
That would be very good without the fiscal note. Representative Meekins.
I'm moving to ask the unanimous consent that the House Finance Committee report out House CS for Senate Bill number 545 the issue.
Is there any objection? Not Senate Bill 545 is moved out of committee. Thank you, Mr. Cook. The next bill we'll take up is Senate Bill 658. Senate Bill 658 is sponsored by the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee and increases the fees for commercial fishing license from $10 to $30 for residents and $30 to $90 for non-residents. The House Resource Committee adopted a committee substitute which adds another section related to annual fees for the issuance and annual renewal of entry and interim use permits. Currently, the statute provides that the annual fee shall be no less than $10 and no more than $750. and shall reflect the different rates of economic return for the different fisheries. The CS adds a requirement that the annual fee amount for a non-resident shall be 3 times the amount of the annual fee for a resident. There is an amendment in your bill file to correct a drafting error. The fiscal note for resource committee substitute indicates that $260,000 is expected in additional general fund dollars, while $460,000 is expected in sick and disabled fishermen funds. Is there anybody here to testify on Senate Bill 658? Mr. Painter?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Roger Painter, and I'm speaking for the United Fishermen of Alaska. This bill, as you may have gathered, is designed to put more money in the Fisherman's Fund, which is kind of a workman's compensation program for fishermen. The program recently ran into some problems. We investigated a number of alternatives to get more money in there. It's a constitutionally dedicated fund, so it's very hard to tamper with. The only way that we found to get more money in there to continue the program is through raising license fees. And it is the difference between resident and non-resident fees is based on the number of court decisions which allow the states to have non-resident fees 3 times higher than resident fees. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
That's the only, I think it's a fine idea, but I'm just wondering about the constitutionality that you say. Have any of our attorneys decided that it probably worked, or is it, who has made this judgment that the court's decision allows us to charge 3 times?
Mr. Chairman, that's been decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. There's been a number of challenges from other states. I think the one that's cited the most often comes from hunting fees in the state of Ohio.
Thank you.
Is
there any other questions? Is there an amendment? Drafting error that was made that I just need an amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move that on page 1, line 14, after the word N-O-N, non, insert transferable. Commercial fishing license shall be retained in the... This is a drafting error. The line was inadvertently left out of the Resources Committee substitute. I move and ask unanimous approval of the correction.
Is there any objection,
Mr. Chairman?
Representative, for the on the amendment.
Yes.
Representative Meekins.
I'm just having trouble making it make sense. On line 14,
line
the very last
14,
very last word there, non.
Page 1. It says after non, insert transferable.
Okay. Oh, insert transferable. The commercial fishing license shall be retained in the
possession. Yes,
okay.
Correct.
All of that. Okay.
All
thank you.
Correct.
Thank you. I remove my objection.
If there's no objection, the amendment is adopted. Representative Fuller.
I move the bill with
Chairman, just to interrupt you, I apologize for that. Can I ask Roger a question?
Yes.
Under debate, Representative Hagen.
Well, this isn't really a debate. I just want to clear something up. You have to actually have a license of purchase in the same year as you are entitled to those benefits?
Mr. Chairman, this program, Fisherman's Fund Program, is designed primarily to cover crew members aboard the vessels. And how the it actually covers any fisherman, though, that is a licensed fisherman, that has either a crew member's license or an entry permit or an entry use permit.
Well, the question I'm asking is talking about, you know, most of those old timers don't have any type of hospital insurance or anything like that, you know, retirement benefits, and now since the public health hospital in Seattle has been closed, I'm just thinking about those fellas. I know several cases of guys that have retired from fishing and have no other way to go but GR Med or something like that. I'm not going to belabor it, but I think it's something you folks should be thinking about in the future, and I'll cooperate with you folks.
Thank you, Mr. Painter. Representative Fuller?
I move House Committee substitute for Senate Bill 658, Finance amended. Ask for unanimous consent.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Representative Meekins?
Do I understand the motion to be a Finance Committee substitute for the original?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Is there any objection? If no objection, Senate Bill 658 is moved out of Finance. The next one we're going to take up is SDR 44. SCR 44 will extend the life of the Commission on the State Personnel Act through June 30, 1983. A physical note prepared by the Legislative Affairs Agency indicates the Commission will need 100,000 to continue its operation during FY83. Representative Cotton.
I move we pass that SCR 44 and ask unanimous consent.
Is there any objection?
Object to unanimous. I will withdraw my rejection.
Okay.
I withdraw.
Right.
Individual move.
Fine.
Yeah. SCR 44 is moved out of House Finance.
The work's all around.
The next one we're going to take up is Senate Bill 275. This is sponsored by Senator Catula. It provides for the compensation of vendors who sell hunting and fishing licenses and game tags at $50 per year or $1 for each license, whichever is greater. The Senate Resource Committee sees this is the version before Senate Finance. It makes a few changes to the original. Second sponsor substitute by providing for an immediately effective date and makes the bill retroactive to January 1st, 1982. It also adds provisions dealing with payment of compensation. A fiscal note by the Department of Revenue indicates that $523,800 loss in general funds can be expected due to compensation payment. We have here to testify Senator Farragut.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative. What's the number of the bill? It is Senate Bill 275.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 275 was through the Senate Resources Committee. It's there have been complaints for years that the people who are selling, the vendors who are selling and feeding hunting licenses are not being properly compensated. We had testimony from vendors, from DNR, from Fish and Game, others who were involved with this bill. And the funds in the Resource Committee, comes from the Resources Committee for this bill. It's endorsed by Commissioner School, by the vendors, and others involved. I'll be trying to answer questions. I feel a little bit embarrassed in that I did not realize the three of these bills were up and did not bring them back up. I was saying for
them. Is there any questions from any members regarding Senate Bill 275?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, this meeting.
Can I have the Resource Committee report read that, please?
Just a minute, please. Carol?
Flying Blue Pass, Setcliffe, Grusendorf, Pines, Bannon, Head Recommendation, Crawford.
Thank you. Representative Meekins?
Moving to ask and ask consent that the House Finance Committee pass out CS for second sponsor up to percent of 275 resources.
Is there any objection? Senate Bill 275 is moved out of Finance. The next one we're going to take up is Senate Bill 525. This one is sponsored by Senator Catula. Representative Cotton.
Can you pick that one up at the end of the calendar and take a 5-minute recess at this time?
Sure. At this time, we'll take a 5-minute recess and be back here at 3:00. We've got two more bills to take up. The next bill is Senate Bill 525. It's sponsored by Senator Catula. It amends the Alaska Lands Act to allow the Commissioner of Natural Resources to adopt regulations which specifies qualifications for lottery participants in addition to those specified. The current law requires that the adopted regulations be different to those specified. The House Resource Committee adopted a committee substitute which adds sections related to appraisal of state land to be sold or leased. A fiscal note by the Department of Natural Resources indicates the bill has no fiscal impact. We have here to testify. Is anybody here to testify on Senate Bill 772? Dr. Byrne, Representative Byrne, then.
Sure. Mark Whittle for the Department of Justice at the same time might be helpful.
Senator Bradley, we had your bill up in the past House Finance. Thank
Sorry,
you.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, I had an appointment with Mr. Ron Watt. Just got out.
He comes first.
We buried that bill already.
Who was that?
Thank you, sir. Thank you all.
Mr. Chairman,
I'll be buried as a Paul Buck.
Representative Byrne.
The changes made in this bill are satisfactory to the department, and Mr. Woodoff of the department will discuss them briefly.
Okay. There are a couple of glitches, I guess, in the drafting of the bill. And for the record, I'm Mark Widow from the Department of Natural Resources. If I could have your indulgence to just point out, the way we'd like to see them change, and Dr. Burns, that we worked with originally in the language, has agreed. On page 2 of the bill, line 5.
Is this in our bill packet, lines 5, line 14, and lines 24?
Okay, yes, you already have that.
You do have the amended changes that Mr. Widow is talking about in your bill packet. Please continue.
Okay. I don't believe that the intention was to repeal B as evidenced by section 4, because it's referred to, I think somewhat mistakenly, in section 2. We just tried to correct it to what we thought Dr. Byrne and Representative Fanning were trying to do in the section, which is basically to allow, in certain cases, land to be sold for less than fair market value if there are compelling reasons.
Representative Carney.
Have you checked with the prime sponsor of this legislation to see if he's in agreement with the amendment?
Yes, I have, and he's in agreement with it.
Thank you.
Continue. Any other questions? Representative Cotton.
Yeah, I got an amendment I'd like to offer, and maybe these two could respond to it. As okay.
Well, why don't, if there's no objections, I'll entertain the motion to for this these set of amendments. Representative Meekins?
Chairman, I move Nancy Hampshire's consent that we adopt the amendments on line 5, line 14, line 24, as outlined by this paper in our document.
Any objection?
Mr. Chairman, if I can see your paper in your file, I don't want to if we delete section 4, we don't want to repeal that. The department did not want to repeal that. That was a technical error, was that correct?
Yeah, that's true.
So we'd strike line 24 then, right?
Right.
We don't want line 24 then.
Okay.
That's what we would do.
Yeah, okay. So make it work from here.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I withdraw the previous motion.
Any objection? If not, it's removed. Representative Meekins?
I move that we adopt amendment on line 5, deleting the following words, or D of this section, and that we insert in its place 38.05.061.
And the other one? Go ahead with the other one.
And line 14, delete the word notwithstanding and insert subject to. And on line 24, delete that entire line, section 4, AS3805310B is repealed. Delete that entire line on section 4.
That's correct.
Is there any objection?
On line 5, there probably ought to be an and, just because that's the end of the sentence, right?
You deleted or, so you need to put or back in.
Or instead of and, yeah, or.
Okay. Is there any objection to adding or? No objection. Is there any objection to the amendment? No. The amendment is passed. Representative Cotton?
Mr. Chairman, I introduced a bill, House Bill 871, earlier this year, and it was a pretty minor area in Title 38 and never even asked to have the bill moved. I've since checked with both co-chairmen of the Resources Committee, and their feeling is that if this committee would adopt the bill in the form of an amendment to this bill, they wouldn't have any objection to it. Very simple note here. Whenever you buy land at a subdivision or any other state sale, and you pay pay for it on an installment plan, you have to pay interest. And the way the law reads right now is that the interest rate to be charged on installment payments is the, here it goes, the prevailing rate for real estate mortgage loans made by the Federal Land Bank for the Farm Credit District 4 of Alaska at the time the contract is signed. And my amendment would say, or 9%, whichever is less, so that you know that it's a constant rather than a fluctuating interest rate that people are going to have to put up with. 9% would be less than what they're charging now. I don't know how much less. So there would be a prospective loss in revenues to the state, but I think it would make it a lot easier for people to make their payments. It would probably be a little cheaper. Plus, if you have a constant, and no, it would never be over 9%.
I have no problems with that amendment, but I would like it in writing for each of the members, Representative Cotton.
Right.
If I can have copies made. Maybe for each of the members, so we can see this and act on it. Representative Meekins?
Just a question for us to Mr. Widow is that I don't have any objection to the amendment either, but one of the things that bothers me about our land policy is that we have seemingly contradictory events. I mean, I expect that there's late payment charges or other kinds of interest that are charged now that are the market rate or higher. Now, and I think that you know, this is just one example of that. Because we'll change it here, there'll be other kinds of land actions that we take as a state that will have different interest payments. Wouldn't that be true?
Yes.
And I'm in favor of this. I think this is a good amendment, but what bothers me is sort of we do it in a sort of fragmented way, and then we have situations where, for instance, in one, you know, one area we may be giving away land, and another we may be, you know, refusing to sell it, you know. And people that are willing to buy it in one area, but we won't sell it, we're just going to lease it, but in another area we're going to give it away or make it essentially free for, you know, sweat equity or something like that. And those kinds of policies are really inconsistent, I think, internally, it seems to me, unless they're based upon something. But most of the time they're not. It's just that here was a policy, and it's been there for 20 years, and then we have this new program, which is much more liberal, but it didn't extend it to the other place. I just want to point out that, you know, this is going to cause an inconsistency, that the people under this program are going to be paying 9%, and under another program may be paying 16, 17%, maybe even higher.
President Cotton, you wanted to remark to that?
Okay, I think it'd be a lot simpler if we could get a vote on it. People aren't interested in dealing with it here. That's fine, then I won't bother, you know, wasting a bunch of paper and so forth. It's pretty straightforward. If somebody had a question about it, which they'd ask, otherwise, why don't we just put it to a vote, and then if it doesn't pass, well, then let's forget it.
Any further questions on the motion? Would you like that motion restated? A motion was made by Representative Cotton that the interest rate on sale of land be 9% for the wording in that area. Is that correct, Representative?
Right now they describe what the rate is, so I would add the words or 9%, whichever is less.
Less.
So okay. You'd bring it down to where it'd be no more than 9% for installment payments on land that are 057, 078.
Mark?
I just want to make sure something. The legislature obviously can set the interest rate. You know, I won't offer any comment on that, but if you do it, it would be, I would just ask that you make sure that you do it for contracts issued after the effective date of the act. And I think you might have done language for that, just because it would be unfair for people that were bidding before to have a different interest rate now than they were led to believe at the time they did.
Representative Cotton.
Yeah, then the other half of the amendment would be that this applies to land contracts issued after the effective date of this act.
Okay.
I think that's probably the proper thing to do.
Representative Carney.
I have a question on that. Do we have real estate contracts now with individuals from the state where the interest rate escalates on a contract after it's signed? We don't, do we?
No,
at the time the contract is signed, as soon as what the interest rate is when you get your loan might be 14% when you sign your contract. The next guy signs his contract and it's down to 12. So that's what his is for the entire length of the contract. That's what's wrong with it, see, because it fluctuates every time a new contract is issued. It's a different interest rate for somebody. So it should, you know, that's why I'd say put it down 9%, whichever is less, and that's probably going to be a constant.
The original intent there was to have the interest rates tracked by real estate market in general.
Well, Carney?
My question alludes to the possible inference that we would be doing something retroactively, and I don't think by changing this that we would do anything retroactively, that those contracts are already in existence and they would stay in existence.
Correct.
They would just apply to future contracts. I don't think, unless we put in there, this shall be retroactive for 1920 or something. Why?
I think Representative Cotton's motion there is just when this takes effect on this effective date.
It's what do they call it sometimes? You got the belt and the suspenders on, you're sure of it this way.
There's a motion. There's a motion amendment before you. All in favor of that motion signify by raising your hand. Opposed? Motion carries. Would you get the proper wording for...
Yes.
For
being, it's being done right now.
Okay, Representative Cotton, I'm Meekins.
You raised the motion?
Yes, I am. Is there any further amendments? Not Representative Meekins.
I move that the consent the House Finance Committee pass out a Finance Committee substitute incorporating the amendments we just adopted for Senate Bill number 525.
Is there any objection? Senate Bill 525 is moved out of committee. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senate Bill 772 is sponsored by Senator Katula. It appropriates $400,000 to DNR to construction of a plant quarantine station at the Plant Material Center, which is operated in cooperation with the Institution of the Agriculture Science. Is there anybody here to testify on Senate Bill 772?
Good bill.
I'm here for bill, Mr. Chairman.
Did you want to testify? No? Representative Carney. There's a motion before you. Is there any objection? No objection. Senate Bill 772 is moved out of House Finance. House Finance is adjourned for one.
Where's she getting at?
House Finance will come to order. Let the record show we have a quorum. The first bill I'm going to take up this afternoon is Senate Bill 872. This is sponsored by the Rules Committee at the request of the governor. It relates to quality control in the seafood processing industry. The bill gives the Commissioner of Environmental Conservation the power to issue permits related to the enforcement of quality assurance plans developed in cooperation with appropriate industrial representatives. It also provides that a processing establishment or vessel may not be operated without the plan of operation approved by the Commissioner. The bill directs the Alaska Seafood Market Institute to design an inspection seal that will signify that a seafood product has been packed in compliance with the requirement. It also directs DEC to conduct research leading to improved techniques to improve sanitation practices, surveillance, and inspection activities. A fiscal note by the DEC indicates $685,500 will be needed to carry out the required activities under this bill. The Senate also approved a letter of intent indicating that an inspection seal shall not be used until authorized to do so by DEC commissioners. It also asks that DEC provide the Alaska Seafood Market Institute with a list of processors that have to comply with the permitting and plan of operation provisions. This afternoon we have a number of people here to testify on the bill. We'll start off with Representative Eric Sutcliffe. I do have before you a House Committee substitute for Committee substitute for Senate Bill number 872, which finance, which I'll be dealing with. Representative Sutcliffe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The recommending Eric Sutcliffe, Representative District 15. This is a bill that that began and mostly after the botulism incident in the salmon industry, and addresses some concerns of DEC that have been basically been okayed by both fishing and processors. The intent is not to overreact from the incident, the crisis, the salmon crisis, but to begin a plan that will hopefully enable the DEC to make sure, as much as you can ever make sure, that the incident will not repeat itself. I don't know whether or not Dr. Hansinger was planning to address the bill itself, and I think rather than my taking up the time, we did look at the bill for expedient sake in resources, but referred it up to you, and so I support the committee substitute. So I should get out of your way here and let
Doctor. Okay, thank you very much. Before I get with the doctor, is Representative Gardner, you did not want to testify. Okay, thank you. Doctor? Take care. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Fred Hunsinger. I'm director of the Division of Seafood and Animal Industries in the Department of Environmental Conservation. We have reviewed this committee substitute, and first, I might state that Mr. Mueller had hoped to be here this evening, but he had to go to Anchorage this evening, and he reviewed this with me this afternoon, and his feel that this has been worked out, committee substitute. He's very much in line, I think, and agrees with the amendments that have been placed into the bill. I think there's been a couple of minor changes only from the Senate version, and I think he had requested that in 025 on page 2 that the words proposed be placed back in four different areas there, and I understand now that they have been replaced in the last version. I might touch a little briefly on the fiscal note and review it with you. $500,000 of that is actually for research money. We have been approached by several different entities now on some advanced technology for can integrity, and also some work on not only botulism but some other research I think that we need as far as backup to our field inspectors that we'll need in the future. We also, I think, at the end of the bill, as most of you are aware, it provides that by January 30th of 1983, we have to get back to the legislature with a what we feel would be a an adequate and fully staffed seafood inspection program that would include a backup of some additional laboratory services. I might point out, I don't know how aware you are of the size of the fishery program in the state of Alaska. We presently have 181 shore-based plants under certification. We have over 150 floater processors, and we have between 40 and 60 harvesters of clams, oysters, and oysters. We have 9 field inspectors, and the only comparable, I think, program on the West Coast might be the fishery inspection program that Canadians operate in British Columbia. They have 134 plants, shore-based plants, no floaters. They have an inspectional staff, which includes both field inspection, administrative, and laboratory services of 57 people. So you can see with only 9 people and having over 400 units to inspect, it runs us pretty thin. One of the hardest problems we have at the present time are the floaters. I think no other state in the union has the problems we have with over 150 floaters in the fishery at the present time, and I'm sure we'll have more as each year goes by. They create some horrendous travel problems to us, and they have some problems that you just don't run into with some of your shore-based plants. And it's going to be a continuing problem for us, I think, in the fishery. And we have some real severe problems out there at the present time with some of the floaters.
At this time, you feel, Doctor, that this is sufficient to take care of the assessment of botulism and other organisms in the seafood processing at this particular point?
Well, the difficult part is to get good quality inspectors, and I think this is about the best that we could come up with for the upcoming salmon season. But I think we will come back the following January with a fully outlined program for you that I think the next session will look at.
Questions? Representative Chuck Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I read through this bill here, and I still do not see where it would give the processors the assurance of that the botulism or can with a botulism will be prevented. If it's a tiny hole, I'm sure it'll be. Plus, we're dealing with a large volume per minute. How what steps are you proposing other than running a clean operation, et cetera?
Well, first, I don't think there's anybody in the world can assure you that there isn't going to be a minute amount of bad product get out, no matter how many people you have in the canneries. But at least we can set up a program that will give you much more security than we have out there now. I think any vaccination program, nobody can guarantee you 100%. All we can do is say you're going to have 85% or 90% more protection if you're vaccinated, if you're not vaccinated for a disease. Nobody will give you 100% assurance. All we can do is build a program that I feel that we feel it would be only rather minute amounts, if any, that gets through. And there are some, I think as we set up these quality assurance programs on a plant basis, we already have one. We have for the last 2 years operated a quality assurance program with one of the larger packers, and it's worked very well. And we do the monitoring. They provide us with the plan and assure us of the quality people in the plant working and are certified to do the various key jobs in the canneries. And these are the areas, I think, where we're going to have to go in and work very carefully with industry in making sure that we have quality people working in those key jobs where we feel that we've got to provide that quality assurance and the protection for the consumer. But the one thing that sometimes gets lost, I think, in the fiscal aspect of this whole thing is, I think the number one priority that never should be overlooked, and that is the public health and the protection of that final consumer. That should be everybody's number one priority. I think it gets lost sometimes when we get into the fiscal aspects of these things.
Well, sir, I would think it would be in the best interest of the industry to assure a good chance of quality for the product when it finally leaves the facilities out to the consumer. And I hope we're not creating just another red tape for those people out there in the industry and create a hardship when in fact they may have gone through the steps of trying to assure the good quality of product.
Well, it's not only in the canned salmon aspect, the Alaskan fishery is very diversified. We get involved in everything from abalone to herring to crab, shrimp. Now we're getting into an old fishery that's just getting renewed, and that's salted cod. We have all aspects of these things, and it's not just only in the canned salmon that we have some real concerns. We have some monstrous concerns of water quality that I think poses one of the biggest dangers probably in the fishery today.
Thank you.
You said you have, what, nine inspectors right now? And you hire five more?
Nine full-time field inspectors.
Right, and you're going to get five more contract employees for the next.
Yes, and you would upgrade two part-time positions that we have now that are our three-month permanent part-time positions.
Okay. But do you think that's going to be enough, or did you say that was all you thought you could
find? Well, I think that's all we can really build into the program for this coming season. First place, it's hard to find qualified people. You just can't put anybody out there.
Have you got some people lined up already? Huh?
Yeah, we have some quality people. The contract inspectors, for the most part, I think we would use primarily maybe in the air shipment of salmon. About one out of every six salmon now is taking an airplane ride. And we get caught in the middle of trying to monitor the air flights plus the canneries. You run yourself pretty thin. I think with the contract inspectors,
if not, the chair will entertain a motion to move out House Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for Senate Bill number 872 Finance with a fiscal note of $685,500, and also included in that is the letter of intent.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Montgomery.
I move that we report out the bill referred to, including the fiscal note and the letter of intent.
Is there any objection? Senate Bill 872 is moved out of Finance. The next one we'll take up is Senate Bill 697. Senate Bill 697 is sponsored by Senator Katula. It alters the structure of the Alaska Renewable Resource Corporation by establishing the Alaska Resource Corporation under the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. A sectional analysis is contained in your bill file, a fiscal note by Divisions of Loan and Veterans Affairs Fund, the $1,154,000 out of the program receipts. This funding level contains the same level of staffing as ARRC currently has, less the full-time trustees. Is there anyone here to testify on Senate Bill 697? Thank you, Mr. Spear, if there's any questions. Representative Cotton? Yes. Representative, did you have something, Representative?
Yes, I do have an amendment.
Representative Chuck, I would at this time entertain any amendments. Do you have copies?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. On page 10, line 11. After the word applies, insert only. And also on the same page 10, line 13, after the word act, insert the following language. This act does not limit the authority of the Alaska Resources Corporation to continue and sustain investments made before the effective date of this act by the Alaska Renewable Resources Corporation. And I have a gentleman here to testify on behalf of the amendment.
Representative Chuck Walk, would you move the amendment for further debate?
I move the amendment.
Is there objection? Is there objection? No objection. The amendment is will be put in bill. Representative Cotton.
Mr. Speaker, I move that we ask unanimous consent to report out a Finance Committee substitute for Senate Bill 697.
And a fiscal note of shown on our package on April 15th, and that's for unanimous consent. Is there any objection? If not, Senate Bill 695 is moved out of Finance. The next bill we'll take up is Senate Bill 69. Senate Bill 69 is originally sponsored by Senator Stimson. It enables the court to require a driver to successfully complete a driver's improvement course upon the accumulation of 6 or more points during a 6-month period or 9 or more points during any 24-month period. The bill also adds a new section to the Motor Vehicle Safety Responsibility Act requiring proof of financial responsibility. The section prohibits reinstatements of the driver's license that has been revoked or suspended under specified circumstances until that person have provided proof of financial responsibility for the future. It also gives the department the option of requiring similar proof that the driver accumulates 6 or more points during 6-month period, and it may suspend the license if the proof is provided. The House Judiciary Committee adopted a CS which adds a new section dealing with financial responsibility. The fiscal note by the Department of Public Safety indicates that additional 6,080 individuals will be required to maintain proof of financial responsibility for the future. As a result, the Division of Motor Vehicle anticipates such notice will cost $9,600 in FY83. We have to testify on this, Bill Brown of Division of Motor Vehicles. See him.
I'm here basically to answer any questions if anybody has
any. Okay. Is there any questions regarding this bill? Representative Cotton?
Move the bill.
Is there any objection? And if not, Senate Bill 69 is moved out of committee. The last bill we're going to take up today is Senate Bill number 5856. It's sponsored by the rules at the request of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. It increases the interest rate on all delinquent state taxes to 12% per year. Current law sets the interest rate at 8% unless other rates are specifically called for. The interest rate on overpayments is also increased from 8 to 12%. Interest on all delinquent oil and gas property production taxes will be at 12%. A fiscal note from the Department of Revenue indicates an additional $700,000 in revenues to the general fund can be expected. We have to testify or answer any questions on this. Is Robert Kessel, of Director of Audit Division. Mr. Kessel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I will keep my testimony brief. The same provisions of Senate Bill 856 are contained in House Bill 101, which has passed the Senate and is back in the House for concurrence. The department supports Senate Bill 856. We recommend that it be passed out of committee and held in ruse until we see what happens to House Bill 101.
Appreciate your assistance on the management of the legislature.
That's awesome.
Representative Carney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any reason that we didn't include an escalation clause in here, or did we, that keeps pace with inflation? So we want to do this again.
No reason that don't.
No reason that you didn't?
We gave that some consideration, but we decided to go with a fixed rate.
Why was that?
Well, basically the Internal Revenue has a fixed rate that's tied to the prime interest rate, and it's adjusted I think they adjust it every 2 years, so it's fixed for a short period of time, but it's nonetheless a fixed rate. Having a flexible rate, I think, creates some difficulty in administering taxation.
Well, if the federal government does it every 2 years, that seems reasonable to me. I'm curious if we didn't do the same thing.
Well, we don't have any strong adversity to the flexible rate.
This recommendation here came from Budget Notice, is that correct?
Their recommendation, I believe, related to the interest rate for delinquent oil and gas property production. Okay. That's correct.
What's the pleasure? Is there any further questions?
What's the pleasure? I think we should amend it to take the prime rate and adjust it every 2 years, the same way the federal government does. I'd like to throw the idea out for discussion, please.
Okay. Representative Cotton.
This is a question on sort of a different subject, but do I read this fiscal note right? We expect to receive less revenues as a result of passing this bill?
Increased
revenue.
You would increase the revenue by in each year approximately $700,000 into the general funds.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Bettesworth, we're still in relation to Representative Carney's question.
Another question in regards to that is the 12% present prime rate level.
No, I think the present prime rate is probably close to 20%, 18 to 20%.
So the Department of Revenue then is collecting 18 to 20% if they've adjusted it recently. I mean the federal revenue. And so if we were to increase ours to that level, we'd be getting another, how much, another $700,000 in income?
If it, we increased it from 12 to 18, for example, I guess we'd be getting about that.
Representative Bettesworth, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This would be an opportunity to clear up some questions that I've had and haven't had a chance to. Is it true that you have the opportunity under current statutes to charge a person a penalty on the full amount of his taxes if he short pays those taxes only an amount of a few dollars for the full year, for the full amount?
That's correct. The failure to file penalty is based on the actual tax liability and not on the additional tax due.
I think that's terrible.
Mr.
Chairman, let me explain. I owe the state $1,000 by their calculations. I calculated $990. They recalculated it, find out that I've erred in what I owed the state. They come back and charge me a penalty, not on the $10 difference, but on the full $1,000 taxes that I owe.
Let me clarify that. This is a failure to file. If you filed a tax return and paid $900 and the liability was $1,000, the penalty is only on the extra $100. But if you failed to file a return and had submitted estimated payments, the failure to file penalty is on the total tax liability. But if you have actually filed your return, the penalty is only on the differential between the additional liability determined and the amount that you paid.
Well, I have letters from a competent certified accountant that says that my analysis is correct and that his is incorrect. And on the basis of that, as long as they're paying charging penalties, regardless at what rate, on what I consider amounts that should not be penalized in the first place, there's no way could I support an additional interest rate on funds that I don't believe should be penalized.
I've got Representative Montgomery. You want to comment?
Just briefly. I've had the same comments from CPAs in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau. And last year at the hearings within the Judiciary Committee, last April and May, we took testimony on that on House Bill 187. And it stated what Representative Bettesworth had stated, in essence. That bill is, incidentally, up for in the limbo file tomorrow. I hope you remember that. I think you and I are on it. But the testimony that we took from the CPA stated exactly what Representative Bettesworth said, and I feel the same way he feels about it.
Representative Cuddy.
I'd certainly agree with Representative Bettesworth that that ought to be changed, but to me that doesn't have anything to do with this issue here. We have an interest rate that's too low and it ought to be changed. Now, Representative Bettesworth is right. There's another problem that ought to be changed, but the fact that we have a problem with a tax law that has to be changed, to me, doesn't have anything to do with the fact that we're undercharging on the the delinquent taxes here. And it seems to me that this ought to be passed out, and if we've got another way of changing that other law, then we ought to change that, but we certainly don't want to have two wrongs make a right, and just because we have a problem that Representative Bedgeworth talks about, we don't want to have the other wrong of having a grossly under a low amount on the interest rate. And I would certainly like to see us go ahead and pass this out and hope that somewhere else we can also fix the other problem up.
Thank you. Representative Carney.
Thank you, Chairman. Well, I appear to be the only one that has a concern about the level of the penalty. If this were an interest charge for all taxpayers, then I wouldn't be in favor of making it large. But we're talking about a penalty here for people who fail to pay. It becomes good business when the interest is low enough to not pay. If you have to borrow money at prime rate, you're only paying 12% to the state. Why, it's good business not to pay. So I'm not going to propose the amendment. It's obvious there isn't support for it, but I think it's something we should do.
Thank you, Representative Carney. Representative Cotton.
Yeah, I'd probably support it. I think that's what IRS just did. I've been making money off for a couple of years doing just what you're talking about. But I'd move the bill.
Okay. Indicating additional 700,000 revenues as fiscal note. And is there any objection? If not, Senate Bill 856 is moved out of finance. Would you sign that? We'll come back at 5 p.m. tomorrow night to take up those bills I announced on the floor.
I thought we were coming at 8:30 in the morning.
House adjourned. Let the record show I have a quorum. Please note the people present here on the committee. The first bill I'll take up this afternoon is Senate Bill 327, sponsored by Senator Parr. It makes a number of changes in the parole system, as well as continues the existence of the Board of Parole until June 30th, 1986. The House Judiciary Committee adopted a CS which makes several changes to the Senate version. First, it provides for the release of a parolee who has been on parole for 6 years unless the board determines after a hearing that continued supervision is necessary for the protection of society. The Senate version provides for release after 5 years of parole if the parolee has been absconded or been charged with a felony since entering parole. The CS also provides that a board may, at its discretion, discharge a parolee from supervision after he has completed 2 years of parole. It also requires the board to biennial review a record for discharge after a parolee has been under supervision for 2 years. The Senate version provides for release on discretionary parole after 20 months on parole. In addition to some other changes, CS also adds that a prisoner released on parole must refrain from violation of municipal ordinance as well as state or federal law. The CS also provides that a member of the parole board may be removed by the governor for conviction of a felony. The judicial CS puts a January 1st, 1983 effective date on the bill instead of June 29th, 1982. A fiscal note by the parole board indicates that $56,800 is needed to operate during FY83. However, due to the new legislation not being effective until January 83, the fiscal note can be decreased by 50%, bringing the cost down to $29,900. A fiscal note by the Divisions of Corrections indicates zero fiscal impact for them. We have to testify this afternoon, Sam Trevett, with the parole board. Mr. Trevett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Essentially, I think...
For the record, your name, please.
My name is Samuel H. Trivett. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Parole Board. I believe the summary you've given is quite accurate. The changes that were made in the House are supported by this department, and we feel we're positive changes. The fiscal note, as you've indicated, has been reduced by about one half to indicate the fact that the bill does not take effect until January 1, 1983, which will take us down to a fiscal impact this coming fiscal year of $29,900. And essentially, I believe we've covered the high points of the bill. We do, I believe, have a copy of our fiscal note and also have a copy of the position paper that was signed by Commissioner Berman on April 21st, 1983, 82, rather. And I would just be willing to answer any questions that the committee members might have regarding this fiscal note.
Thank you. Representative Cotton.
On the compensation and expenses, do the board members get $150 a day right now?
No, sir. Right now, that amount is not set by statute. The governor determines that right now it's $100 a day.
$100 a day. Yes. Is that only while attending board meetings? This language says while each day the board member is conducting the business of the board. I'm not sure what the difference between attending a board meeting and conducting a business of the board is.
Essentially, right now, as you've indicated, they only get paid for attending board hearings. If this bill is enacted the way it reads right now, Representative Cotton, what it would do is that in, while they're preparing for board hearings, for example, they receive files from the Division of Corrections 2 weeks in advance of hearings. While, and they read those in the evenings or weekends before they go to hearings. We would, in fact, then be required to pay them for that time. If, in fact, they are in, say, a meeting over the telephone with us, a conference telephone call, which is a very common occurrence to deal with administrative issues, then we would pay them for those kinds of things also. Primarily, the biggest amount, though, is to pay them for reading files before the hearings themselves, which shortens, of course, I mean, the hearing time.
Which is that usually what takes a day to go?
We have the figures. I think we figure probably about three quarters of an hour per file. We run through about 300 hearings a year, so confident enough.
300 hours, is that what you're saying?
I think we figured about 23 days a year total, 23 days per board member per year.
That includes the meetings, huh?
Yes, sir. That doesn't include the meetings. They already paid for the meetings themselves.
In addition to the to the meetings, they do 23 days a year.
Approximately, yeah.
So that's about $3,500 a year. That
right now, they're not being compensated for that, and they're probably spending about half of their time in terms of preparing for hearings as opposed to actually in hearings.
Mr. Chairman, the only reason I brought it up is because it seems like we're very inconsistent when we talk about boards and what their compensation is. And I just wonder why we decided to do it with this one and not all the others.
Do you have an answer for that, Mr. Trivett, on the amount of set for $150 per day on the board compensation?
Yes, sir, Representative Adams. That was set by the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I believe their feeling was in the original version of the bill that came out of the Senate HES Committee, it was set at $100 a day with an increase based upon the consumer price index in the Anchorage area. And they felt that that would just be take a lot of time to mess around with that, and they figured that the compensation hasn't changed in recent years, and that if they set it for $150 a day, that we would expect to stay at that level for probably a decade or so.
Is there any further questions? Representative Carney?
Well, as a result of the questions, I took a look at page 3 where it talks about the $150 a day, and it says, entitled the compensation of $150 per day for each day the board member is conducting the business of the board, and is also entitled to the per diem and travel allowance provided by law for other boards and commissions. And I don't know if it's true that the boards and commissions rates are not consistent, then which allowance are we referring to there after the and?
There are actually, again, continue, Mr. Chairman, there are two things. Number one, there's per diem and travel expenses, which are the same for all boards and commissions throughout the state. I believe that there are some discrepancies in terms of those boards that are actually quasi-judicial decision-making boards, for example, the Fish and Game Board, Education, and some others, workers' comp boards. I don't know the actual rates of those, Representative, but I believe there may be some disparity in terms of what those people are paid.
So to continue, Mr. Chairman, then what this says is that they not only get the $150 a day, they get the per diem that other people are getting.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So what would they be getting then a day?
Well, I believe the current per diem rate, I think, is $80 a day.
So they're getting $230 then?
Yes, sir. Of course, they've got to pay their expenses out of the $80 a day.
Yeah, I know.
Representative Meekins?
I was just going to make that point.
Representative
Cotton? Let me make sure I understand. The per diem is only they're only entitled to per diem for those days that they attend board meetings.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
So that's, how many days a year is that?
It's approximately 40. It can vary.
How many?
Approximately 40.
40 days?
Yes, sir.
So they spend 23 days preparing and 40 days at meetings. So that'd be 63 days. Plus they get another 40 days worth of per diem at $80 a day. So that's 32.
$12,700.
Well, plus they get 6,300 plus 3150. That's $12,650 a year, basically, total, per diem and expense money. Not bad.
That's probably the ballpark, yeah. I think our current expenses for compensation are around $24,000 or $25,000 now. And in the full year, the full fiscal year, this would be around $50,000. So $75,000 figure for all five board members is probably in the ballpark.
And the fiscal notes? I guess I don't understand the fiscal notes. Is there more than one fiscal note?
No, there's one, only one fiscal note. You should be looking at that dated April 16th, 1982. It's for a sum of $29,900.
For the first fiscal year, because yep. that we only have a half of a year in FY23 because the bill doesn't go into effect January 1.
Okay.
In a full year, it would be approximately $58,900 more.
Is there any further questions? What's the pleasure of the body?
Mr. Chairman.
Captain Meekins.
I'd like to have another witness testify.
Okay.
If you'd be willing to.
Fine.
Mr. Stern.
Mr. Stern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Barry Jeffrey Stern. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. I'm going to be very brief about the bill before you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Meekins.
I don't mean to preclude any opening remarks you have, but I'd just like to ask you to cover something in your remarks if you're not planning to otherwise. We had this bill up in the Judiciary Committee, and there are essentially two different concepts about what should be done with the parole board, and I think the bill we have is not the one that I like. It's one that passed the Judiciary Committee, but there is a different approach in terms of how to work this parole situation and what it does, and I'd like Mr. Stern to go over the approach that I think is essentially the administration's position. I'm not sure if that's true, but you could maybe cover that also and explain the differences.
Thank you. I will attempt to be extremely brief. The reason I'm here to testify is because the Department of Law and the administration thinks that this is an extremely important issue in that it addresses two concerns of the legislature this year. First is the crime problem, and the second is simply somehow getting a rein on the cost of incarceration. We strongly oppose the approach taken in this legislation that is before you today in that it continues the Alaska Board of Parole as the body that will have final authority over determining the amount of imprisonment an offender convicted of an offense should serve when it's his first felony conviction. Under current law, a person that has a prior felony conviction who is sentenced by a judge, say to a three-year sentence, is not eligible for parole consideration by the Board of Parole. That person has to serve a sentence. It is our position that presumptive sentencing should apply to all first-time offenders, and they should not be eligible for consideration by the parole board for discretionary parole release. Let me give you an example. A person commits the crime of robbery today or the crime of sexual assault in the first degree, which we would call rape. That person could be sentenced up to a maximum sentence of 20 years imprisonment if it's his first offense. Let's assume the person gets a sentence of 10 years imprisonment. That sentence does not mean that that person is going to serve 10 years in prison. Rather, it means that he will be eligible for release by the parole board after 3 years of a sentence. We oppose that in that we believe it's a legislative function to determine the amount of time a prisoner should serve, and that once a judge has that offender before him, the sentence that is imposed should be specified by the legislature. And if the person later reforms, that's all very well and good, but that person should, there should be some certainty in sentencing that person. So we proposed last year, House Bill 293, which basically abolished the Board of Parole and established fixed sentences for first-time offenders. That bill received pretty extensive going over in the House Hess Committee. And the end result was that a version of that bill was passed out after 2 months of work, and that version was committee substitute for House Bill 225. And that approach is a little different than what the governor originally recommended, but it's certainly something that we could live with. In the House Judiciary Committee, basically gave attention to only one bill, and that was the bill continuing the Board of Parole, which is before you today. Basically only gave maybe about 2 hours of consideration to the bill. We opposed it. We had an opportunity to explain why we opposed it. But we strongly disagree with continuing the parole board in this present form. Another thing I'd like to discuss with you, because this is the Finance Committee, is the fiscal impact of this legislation versus the fiscal impact of the approach that we believe should be adopted by this committee, which is the approach in committee substitute for House Bill 225, which passed the House Hess Committee. Under the 225 approach, Department of Health and Social Services, in a fiscal note, projected a net decrease in prison population resulting from enactment of the legislation by approximately 46 people within 7 years after the bill is enacted. In other words, enactment of House Bill 225, the committee substitute, would effectively decrease prison population. Now, let me point out what our concern is. Our concern is certainty in a sentence, not necessarily the amount of the sentence, but rather that if you go out and commit a sexual assault, your presumptive sentence should be 5 years. The decrease in prison population comes about as a result of furlough programs authorized in the bill, where towards the end of a sentence, the last, I believe, 2 years or one-third of the sentence, the person would be released in a situation where there would be less to the community with supervision, but not in the prison facility per se. Again, I could spend 3 hours going over it. I'm not. I'm just going to say, though, that the bill that passed out of Representative Burns' committee had an effect, I think, of decreasing capital expenditures, perhaps for some current correctional facilities projects in the state, and that's why I'm here today. I'd be happy to answer any questions. It's a long topic, and I'm not going to go over it again. I have had an opportunity to do so, but we would, if you're not, if the committee doesn't agree with the approach in 225, we would at least request simply that the parole board be allowed to sunset the legislature and consider this issue again next year.
Representative Carney.
Thank you, Chair. That would be my question. What would happen if this bill went nowhere? Would that be a disaster?
Well, if this bill went nowhere, the parole board would have 1 year to wind down its business, and that has happened on one other occasion. So the parole board would continue in existence, and the next legislative session, the legislature would have an opportunity to look at the issue again. I should say Senate Judiciary raised that question. Well, basically Senate Judiciary, considering the approach that we're recommending, said, well, this is a governor that's leaving office this year, and we feel somewhat uncomfortable about adopting this approach. Come back next year with it. We would say that it would be easier to come back next year if the legislature is under the fact that the board is going to go out of existence. In other words, this continues the board for another to 1986. It's probably unlikely that the legislature next year would consider revamping it once it's been sunsetted until 1986. So it would not be a disaster. They would still have a year to wind down its business, and the topic could be considered again next year.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative.
Do you think that the parole board would have any difficulty keeping the members who are currently on the board around if we didn't change the compensation and expenses provisions?
I don't feel qualified to answer that. All I can say is that the bill before you, in terms of its changes to the existing parole board, that's one of the few changes made by the bill. Sam Trivet, of course, is in a better position to answer the compensation angle.
Yeah, I'm starting to think that it'd be a good time to leave the bill in the legislature and force the legislature to give consideration next year.
Is there any further questions? Thank you very much, John.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Yes.
Just discussion.
I was just going to ask, is there anybody here else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 327? Parole to offenders? Representative Meekins?
Mr. Chairman, under discussion, I know it's really not, I mean, we could technically, I guess, go through this thing line by line and go over all these things. And that's really, I guess, the purpose of the Judiciary Committee more than our committee, and we'd probably kind of bog down on that. So I'm not advocating that we... I would like to adopt the other bill, not this one. But I didn't prevail on the Judiciary Committee, so probably I should just accept that. But I would think that maybe a consideration of either not passing this bill or passing it with a sunset date quicker, you know, sooner than 1986, so that at least if we can't make this change in terms of wiping out the parole board and having sentences that mean what they say this year, at least we have a chance of doing it next year. One of the things that's always bothered me is in the correctional system is there's so many fingers in the pie. You know, you've got the law, and then you've got the judge makes a decision, and then they get good time deducted from that, and that has nothing to do with whether the guy's going to go out and rape another person. It's just a question of whether he's a good prisoner. And if he's a good prisoner, even though he's a rotten person, he gets this good time, you know, and so he gets one day for every four off of his sentence from what the judge gives him and from what the legislature puts on, just because he doesn't stab anybody in the prison. But if he gets out of prison and goes stab somebody, you know, if he's likely to, they don't take that into consideration when they give him his good time. Then on top of that, you got parole. And if the parole board tries to take into consideration whether this person's going to be a recidivist or not, but I already don't believe that, you know, that should be a function right there. I think they ought to say, if you did this act, it's punishable by this many years in jail, and the judge ought to say 2 years or 5 years or 10 years, and that's what the guy has, and that somebody later ought not to be able to come along and say, well, we're going to change that. We think a little differently than the judge and the jury and all these people that had all this other information about this guy, and we're going to decide that he gets out after only serving a third of that. I don't think that's right. I think the jury and the judge and the prosecutor and all that situation is where the decision ought to be made, and that they'll live with it. So that's my pitch. I'd like to either kill the bill, or if we do, the committee does want to pass it, at least I'd make a motion to change that effective date.
It's my intention to pass the bill out of House Finance and let it have its day on the floor. Representative Carney.
Well, I was going to suggest that we suspend actions of June the 1st in this committee, Mr. Chairman. In light of your previous statement, I'll hold that amendment.
Yeah. Representative Montgomery.
Yes, I'd like to make one comment. I agree partially with what Representative Cotton said. It concerns me not with this particular bill, but with the numerous boards and commissions, and it's not necessarily aimed at this particular one. There is a wide variance, and I think that's a challenge we should all accept as legislators next year to bring in more conformity to that, because I'm disturbed each time I see a different bill and there's a different rate and et cetera. So I think that's a very valid thing. It's not aimed at this particular bill, but it's one that we should all address. And then answer to your second, one of your other questions that Representative Cotton made, as to whether the payment of the money does or does not assure you of good service, I think it's like anything. There was a time when the board served with no fee, no fund, and it was difficult in many cases to get people to take off from their business and work for nothing, but there were some that did. I know that there have been some very dedicated people that have worked on this board. I also would like to comment that I share with some of Representative Meekin's concerns, too. It is a very broad topic, and it's until you really know it and work with it, it's extensive in all the scopes. So it is not an easy topic to approach with a single answer. But I do defend the parole board. The people that have served the last few years have been a very dedicated group, and they've given lots of hours to the job.
Any further comments?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Meekins.
I move we delete Section 3 of the bill on page 14, line 26, or excuse me, line 23. And if I've got this right, what that would do is delete the words that say AS 44-660-10-83 is amended to read, and that section that it's amending currently says 1982, and we're amending it in this bill to 1986, so by striking that language, it means that the board would have 1 year to wind down, which would force the legislature to take action next year one way or the other. We couldn't get away with even doing what we're doing.
Would you restate your motion for the members, please?
My motion is on page 14, line 23, strike the entire Section 3, which essentially means that the board would go out of existence a year from this June 30th.
Unless there was other action.
Unless there was action, the legislature would have to take action one way or the other. But then all this new language would be in effect for that year.
Is there any objection to the motion? No objection. Motion passed.
Mr. Chairman?
Just a minute.
According to my calculations, we're giving the members of the parole board a 57% pay increase.
This is already in there.
I just want all these fiscal conservatives to know that.
I had to tell the lawyers how the things go here.
Yeah. Representative Cotton, did you have anything? Was that just a comment towards the members?
Right. Just all of us who've been fighting about the 4% pay increase for state employees, we're now giving these people a 57% pay increase. So I'd bring that to your attention, case you're interested.
Thank you, Representative Cotton. Representative Carney?
I think it's wise to leave that in. I think it would have a lot less an opportunity getting across the floor of the House.
I didn't make any more.
What's your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman?
Meekins?
Go ahead.
I move and ask unanimous consent that we move out House Committee Executive Committee Substitute Sentinel and 327 Judiciary as a Finance Committee Substitute.
And with a noted fiscal note of $29,900?
Yes.
And ask for unanimous consent. Is there any objection to move out to Finance? Not moved. Senate Bill 327 is moved out of Finance. The next bill we'll take up is House Bill 748, sponsored by a Special Committee on Banking to raise the amount of interest on state bonds and bond participation notes to a fluctuating interest rate that would guarantee the state to at least 11% a year. The rate is currently 10%. The bill also addresses the interest rate of refunding bonds by providing a similar fluctuating interest rate. It also amends the section relating to signatures of notes by the governor and the lieutenant governor and provides that the lieutenant governor's signature may be a maximum signature. And to testify on this bill this afternoon, we have Mr. Stack. Let the record show that Representative Carney excused us.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Anselm Stock. I'm Treasury Comptroller for the Department of Revenue. And just to simply state that, of course, the version of the bill that I have is, of course, Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 748, Finance. We're definitely in favor of the legislation. If there are any particular questions or reasons as to why we're doing this, I should be able to answer them. But other than that, I have no other formal presentation. This is simply as a result of market conditions and by bumping up against the interest rate capper at times that we come to market and try and sell bonds and to provide a method to be able to sell bonds in a very tough market, but provide an interest rate capper through using the bond buyer index that already tracks what general obligation bonds are doing. The particular provision on the use of, by the fact that the lieutenant governor's signature would be by facsimile, is this one became particularly important when we issued bond anticipation notes last December. The only way we could legally issue the bond anticipation notes was that we had to. By the way, on regular bonds, even the long-term bonds, we can use a facsimile signature of both the governor and the lieutenant governor. This just happens to be something that wasn't caught a long time ago. And the only way we could legally issue those bonds and garner the state's $200 million from selling those bond anticipation notes was to fly the lieutenant governor to Chicago, and he had to physically sign 4,000 bonds. And that was the only way we could legally issue those bonds, because the language, both bond counsel and all legal counsel, we said that the lieutenant governor's signature had to be an original signature. So what we want to do is clean up this problem for the next time around.
Representative Cotton?
How long did that take?
It took a total of about a day and a half. It was actually about it took about 8 hours to do the signing, because you do it with there's only two places in the United States where they have these big signing machines where it signs like 50 signatures at a time, but you have 50 original pens sitting there connected to one.
Okay, my question is, I was just curious about that. You got the bill there. On the first page, we say that right now the law is that we can't sell a general obligation bond and pay more than 10% interest. That's current law.
Yes.
So here we're changing it to 11 or this other formula, whichever is higher. What would that other formula be right now, the 110% of the rate of the bond buyer index, 20 municipal bonds and so forth? What is that equal to today?
The bond buyer index, it should be...
What kind of range are we talking about?
Okay, we're talking about a range of... presently, the bond buyer index on 20 municipal bonds is somewhere in the range of, let's say, if it were 10%, okay, then it would be 11% you could sell it at.
What is it today?
If I remember correctly, it's somewhere in the range of about 11.5 to 12.
When's the last time we sold a GO bond?
The last time we sold a GO bond was on March the 10th of this year.
And we got, obviously we were able to sell it for 10% or less.
Yes, and the way we sold that bond was the following. We used a modified method. We knew we were up against the 10% limit. If we had strictly specified the 10% limit, Okay, we specified that the net interest cost on the bonds could not be higher than 10%.